Hello, and welcome to The Iberian Knot, A History of the Spanish Civil War, Episode 9, A Republican Resurgence. I wanted to start this week by thanking the now over 100 people who seem to be listening on a weekly basis to this podcast. I've had a few conflicting priorities in my work and personal life lately that kept me away from writing this last week, but I'm going to just go ahead and promise to you all that I will diligently attempt to continue pumping out these episodes on a weekly basis for you all to enjoy. I know I love the consistency I get from many of my favorite podcasters, so I'll try harder to keep on schedule and continue telling the story which I think is very relevant to our times and in fact is being brought up in current news. I can't really get into this now as I don't want to totally spoil the ending and aftermath of the war, but needless to say that the Civil War and Franco are still painfully relevant to modern Spain and Europe and their politics in 2019. But let's get on with the story of the fall and winter of 1936. If you were listening up until this point, you probably expect me to wrap up this series in a couple more episodes, because what else is there left to play out? The Nationalists have formally given Franco dictator-like powers to run the war, with the combined fascist militias, rebellious military contingents, as well as the planes, boats, and tanks that are being provided by the Germans and Italians. Meanwhile, the Republicans can't stop fighting between themselves, both within and between the major cities on their side, and every country that shares their political views, namely that Spain should be governed by a representative government, had publicly turned their backs on them by joining the Non-Intervention Committee, which willingly ignored German and Italian intervention on the Nationalist side. The Nationalists were closing in on the mountain ranges that surrounded Madrid to the north and were steadily plowing from west to east across Andalusia, Asturias, and the Basque Country to take heretofore Republican-held territory. However, the decision Stalin had made to support the Republican side would start to arrive in force in late October and November 1936. Along with officers who had been battle-hardened by the Russian Civil War came some of the best armaments being produced in the world at the time. The representative for Russia on the Non-Intervention Committee declared on October 28th, in words that were ambiguous but got the point across, that they felt that they were only bound to the Non-Intervention Agreement in the same way that the Germans and Italians were, the subtext being that they would now be sending military as well as humanitarian aid to the Republican side. This would have been no real surprise to anyone on the committee, as the British, French, Germans, and Italians all knew through spies and the large movement of naval vessels through the Black Sea into the Mediterranean that a great deal of support was on its way from Russia to Spain. It would have been an impossible secret to keep, really. The Russians and Stalin seemed to have only wanted to cover their behinds, as it were, and not spark an international conflict with the actions they were in the process of taking. Something like 100 tanks and aircraft arrived in the Mediterranean port town of Cartagena at the end of October and beginning of November, along with a great deal of weapons, trucks, and other arms. The aircraft were mostly of two new types, the Chato and the Mosca, or Fly in English, were faster and more maneuverable than the Junkers and Fiat fighters provided by the Germans and Italians, respectively, and along with a great deal of Russian pilots, the Republicans would soon recover an advantage in the sky. The Russian tanks were also more heavily armored and better outfitted than the Italian Fiat Ansaldos and German Panzers. Many Russian officers sent to Spain around this time would go on to become marshals in World War II. All of this was in addition to millions of gallons of badly needed oil the Russians were providing to the Republican side. As I talked about in an earlier episode, the Germans and Italians were providing assistance to Franco on credit for a few reasons. They thought it was a good investment, as it was internationally believed that the Nationalists would win the war, so they'd be paid back with interest. Italy and Mussolini specifically wanted to get Italy involved in as many conflicts as possible because it would, like, harden the Italian spirit or something like that. Hitler wanted to use Spain as a sandbox to test out his war toys and strategies for an eventual European-wide war of conquest. He was also interested in Spanish minerals to supply his growing military and asked for repayment both in actual money as well as exclusive mining rights in Spain. Franco and his team were happy to sign these notes with promises to repay in the future. It locked the Germans and Italians to them in a way that they might not have realized was so strong in the beginning, and in the end would give Franco power over them. As things progressed and Mussolini and Hitler sometimes disagreed with Franco's decisions in his prosecution of the war, he'd respond with something like, "Well, if you don't like it, feel free to leave. We'll probably lose, and then we'll never repay you. You'll lose your mineral rights, and you'll have a hostile instead of an allied government in Madrid." And with that, they'd have to back down and do what Franco thought was best. The Russians, on the other hand, wanted to be paid up front because even Stalin didn't think he was helping them enough to actually win, nor did he expect them to. His goal was to prolong the war to distract the Germans and Italians, and if he could make money in the offing, all the better. And man, did he get paid for helping the Republican side in the war. When I first read what happened in this regard as I was researching the podcast, I was like, wait, no. That can't be. So Largo Caballero was in fall 1936 recently made prime minister because the Republicans were losing on all sides and needed a more left-wing figure than the prior occupant to hopefully unite the socialists, communists, and anarchists that made up the majority of those on the Republican side in the war. He was desperate for help from any government that was willing to sell them arms or any material. At the time, Spain had the fourth highest gold reserves in the world, probably a lot of it still built up from colonial times, and a great deal of that reserve was in the Bank of Spain in Republican-controlled Madrid. This was a Scrooge McDuck pile of gold and coins. As the nationalists approached the city, it was decided that it was best to move the gold out of the city, and Caballero and his finance minister, Juan Negrin, at first moved it to a cave outside of Cartagena. Then they decided the best place to keep it safe would be to ship it to Russia. For real. And they made that decision without informing the president of the government, the long-suffering Manuela Zanya, or really anyone else in the cabinet. This was instead of sending the gold to a country like the US or the UK, where it would have at least been a public act that could have been put up to scrutiny in the future if the Republicans lost the war. By shipping it off to Russia in payment, they were making sure they'd never see it again. And that's just what happened. The gold left Spain on the 25th of October, and Negrin told the cabinet that it would act like a checking account for the country as it received war material and other aid from Russia while they fought the war. And then, at the end of the war, any balance would be repaid to them in full. The shipment was made in 7,900 boxes loaded by hand on each end of its journey. When the gold arrived, Stalin supposedly held a banquet where he said, "The Spaniards will never see their gold again, just as one cannot see one's own ears," despite promises his government had made to the Republicans in writing. When Manuel Azañac and the moderate socialist Indalecio Prieto found out about this shipment of the majority of Spain's hard currency to the Soviet Union, they were furious, but were afraid that if they left the government in protest, that would only further harm their cause. With the arrival of all of the assistance, both in armaments and in other much-needed commodities from Russia, that country was reaching peak popularity with the masses, so to speak out against them would have lessened their support from the people as well. Besides, Russia was the only country that was willing to support them, either by paying in cash up front or on credit, so what else was there to do? The head of the Russian mission in Spain was a man named General Berzin, or Grishin, and he had arrived in Madrid in September. The head of the Air Force sent by Russia was Colonel Jacob Smushkevich, who went by General Douglas. There was a problematic trend of those officers sent from Russia to Spain to go by pseudonyms, sometimes because the real names were too difficult for Spaniards to pronounce, but other times because the Russians were trying to keep plausible deniability in regards to their intervention in the war. At the same time, the Russians wanted to keep their names off of the international smuggling operation that was being employed to bring weapons into Republican Spain. These groups that were theoretically working to help that side in the war were besieged by profiteers that forced the Republicans to pay far more than the fair value for the goods they received. But the people put in charge of the operations were oftentimes professors and politicians, and not business people, the majority of them being concentrated on the nationalist side. The arrival of the international brigades also helped the Republicans begin to turn back or at least stop the nationalist wave of accomplishments up to that point. Some of the most famous people to fight for or support the Republican side, like Ernest Hemingway and George Orwell, did indeed come from the US and UK, but many also came from countries where authoritarian governments were taking or had already taken over control. The fascist takeover of Italy and the Nazi takeover of Germany had created a large group of people that were exiled from their countries but wanted the opportunity to fight those who had exiled them, even if it was abroad. These brigades began to be organized in each country by the Comintern, and the Communist Party of each country was given somewhat unreasonable recruitment goals to achieve. These volunteers mainly came from the working classes and saw it as the first chance to fight fascism, not just rhetorically, but by taking out its adherents. Some were even veterans of the Great War. The future dictator of Yugoslavia, Josip Tito, was a major recruiter and procured a great deal of travel documents for the Comintern in Paris during this time. The soldiers who arrived in Spain were often shocked by the conditions they found the Republican side to be in. Many first arrivals were housed in a barracks that only days before had been filled with dying soldiers and therefore was splattered with blood like a house of horror, forcing them to cram together on a higher floor where their wounded couldn't previously reach. Upon arriving, they would be grouped according to their language or country background. They would be asked what their specialty was, officer, typist, sniper, or cook, but many named the job they dreamed of doing rather than what they were most fit for. There was no entrance exam, for sure. If there were too few of one language or ethnicity for them to make up their own battalion, they'd be lumped together with other groups. As you could imagine, the language difficulties between the Spanish, Italians, Germans, Russians, Poles, Hungarians, English speakers, and many additional languages would make training and in-the-field military actions often quite difficult. But as the volunteers entered the country through the Pyrenees in the north or the Mediterranean in Alicante, they'd be greeted by crowds shouting their welcome and saying things like "No pasarán," or "They will not pass," or "Salud," and singing the International or other widely known communist and socialist songs. They couldn't have helped but think that they were joining a true revolution that might stamp out fascism once and for all. Many may have been disgusted by their own government's refusal to assist this government that believed in the same values as their countries were founded on, and felt that by fighting on the side of these people, nursing them or reporting on them, they could persuade their countrymen and governments to give greater importance to the conflict and intervene. This was up to and including sacrificing their own lives to the effort. The Communists and the Comintern were happy to link the cause of Republican Spain to their own and receive any shared sympathy it garnered. Looking at it in retrospect, it was almost like Russia wanted to say, "Yes, we may have what seems like an authoritarian government, but really we are focused on the needs of the working class above all, and that class wants Stalin in power. And to demonstrate that we just want what the majority wants, here we are helping the Spanish remain Republican, and if they choose communism when this is all over, great. If not, that's fine too." In reality, the assistance they were sending came with many strings attached, and even the Republican leaders would soon be complaining that the Russian sent officers were acting independently of the government. The arrival of all of this assistance, both in people and material, started to seriously worry the anarchists, who still made up a large portion of the troops and militias on the Republican side. They saw this sudden influx of Russian aid as a threat to their eventual goals in the revolution that they were trying to implement while the central government was relatively weak. They didn't really believe any of the very prominent propaganda the Comintern and the central government was putting out that all of this was being done for the good of the people. They saw themselves slowly losing power already because they were considered sellouts by many of their followers by entering the governments in their stronghold of Catalonia, and also because many of those places held by anarchists were being slowly taken over by the nationalist side. On October 28th, the Republicans would carry out their first major counterstrikes against the Nationalists with the full support of the Republicans and international brigades. Largo Caballero took to the radio and announced that the Republicans would deliver a death blow to Nationalist forces with tanks and powerful airplanes. Positive propaganda messages like these had been broadcast by various actors on the Republican side since the beginning of the conflict, but for once what he was saying was true. That day, a column of 15 tanks supported by a new mixed brigade headed up by Lister collided into the Nationalist cavalry in Cesena to the south of Madrid. I can only imagine what it must have looked like for the most modern tanks of that time to come into conflict with hundreds of men on horseback. The troops supporting this front line of tanks couldn't advance fast enough to cover the territory they had taken, but they nevertheless proved their worth. A squadron of Russian bombers attacked Seville the same day, which must have really rattled the nationalists who were already picking out curtains for the palaces in Madrid. In reaction, the Germans pushed the nationalists to take on more air assistance from them and to allow German officers to lead the initial efforts. Franco wasn't yet in a place to challenge his biggest and most powerful ally, so he allowed for this somewhat humiliating action to take place. Thus entered Germany's famous Condor Legion of aircraft into the war, which would terrify Republican Spain from the sky for the rest of the war. It was led by a Major General von Speer, who was called the most brutal-looking general by Hitler himself. This legion was made up of around 100 aircraft, which consisted of bombers, fighter groups, a seaplane, reconnaissance vehicles, and even some experimental aircraft. Although this squadron would make a huge difference in the war, it was still technically inferior to the aircraft that the Russians were providing the Nationalists at the time. Only one day after the Republicans, with Russian assistance, had bombed Seville, the Nationalists, with German support, started bombing Madrid daily. This was done, in part, as an experiment by the Germans of what they would later call the Blitzkrieg style of warfare. They wanted to see if the constant bombardments would demoralize the Republican side and make them want to surrender, even if their bombers didn't take out militarily important targets. The Nationalists slowly crept closer and closer to Madrid, and each day into November a new town was taken that was supposedly the key to entering the city. People, livestock, and motor vehicles started to crowd the city proper. The approaching Nationalist army spurred the government in Madrid to take on anarchist cabinet members, as had happened already in Barcelona. This was seen as necessary to get full commitments from the people to fight for the government, and show that it supported the hopes of every side that wanted a republic to be the result of the war, even though the previous republic had satisfied no one. The appointment of Federica Montseny, an anarchist intellectual from Barcelona, to the Ministry of Health made her the first female cabinet minister in Spanish history. The Socialist and Communist parties, both in Spain and abroad, lauded the anarchist inclusion in the government as the most transcendental day in the political history of the country. But many anarchists were disillusioned by it. Montseny's own father told her that it would lead to the liquidation of anarchism, and that, once in power, you will not rid yourselves of power. She wrote that in a way she saw her entrance into the government as a split with everything she had worked on in her life up to that point. But desperate times call for desperate measures. The Nationalist military leaders Mola, Varela, and Yagüe decided that they would make their major assault on Madrid in the early morning of November 8th. They wanted to enter the city from the northwest, between the University City and the Plaza de España, after crossing the Casa de Campo, a huge park in the northeast of the city. Right inside the city from that point are the main upper-class neighborhoods of Madrid, where they figured they'd have the most support and hence wanted to reach as soon as possible. Despite their assurances that they'd shortly stamp out the fascist menace Largo Caballero, and other Republican leaders were broadcasting in their newspapers, on the radio, and over loudspeakers, the president, prime minister, and his cabinet were making plans to get out of the city, which they feared would fall to the Nationalists in no time. They at first thought that it would be best to join their Catalonian counterparts in Barcelona, and in fact Manuel Azaña had been sent there in late October ahead of the rest of the government, where he took up residence in the Palacio de la Ciudadela, also known as the Palace of the Parliament of Catalonia. Shortly thereafter, Caballero and his cabinet decided it was better to decamp to Valencia, but told Azaña to stay put in case they had to retreat further anyways in the future. This would isolate Azaña even more and make him somehow even more melancholy and dejected. This plan to evacuate the city was not communicated to the general populace, and many party leaders found out about it right as it was going on. The newly appointed anarchist cabinet members were against so cowardly fleeing the fight and leaving Madrid's residents to their fate, but they didn't feel like they had much choice in the matter and fled along with everyone else. The generals Miaja and Pozas were put in charge of the military organization and defense of Madrid. They were told to defend the city using whatever tactics or maneuvers necessary, and that if they found it impossible to hold back the Nationalist offensive, to retreat in as orderly and unbroken a manner as possible to a place near Cuenca in Castilla-La Mancha. Leaving Madrid posed a problem that has been seen in other times in history, which was, if everyone was leaving the city, and the few that remained needed to be totally concentrated on defense, what do we do with all of the prisoners? A similar situation had occurred at the outset of the French Revolution, when the people believed that Austrian forces were headed to Paris to extract revenge for them having killed their king. And in that crisis, just like this one, they made the same gruesome decision. Around 1,000 prisoners were still being housed in the model prison, and it was proposed to transfer them to a new prison outside of town. In reality, the prisoners were largely butchered at a point just north of the city near the modern-day airport and town of Barajas called San Fernando de Henares. The responsible parties in the government attempted to halt these killings, but mostly failed in that endeavor. The Russian general Berzin was concerned by the massacre, as he was afraid it would hurt international opinion of the Republicans. The residents of Madrid, who were certainly disheartened by the lack of faith the official government clearly had in their efforts, nonetheless rallied to the defense of their city. Many of the defenders were recent refugees to the city from other parts of Spain that had been conquered by the Nationalists, and the international brigades took on their largest part in the war thus far as they marched down Gran Vía in the direction of Casa de Campo and the University City. These international brigades were mostly made up of Germans, French, Belgian, and Poles. However, most people cheering them on in their parade thought that they were representing the long-awaited Russian intervention in the war, so they were praised with shouts of "Long live the Russians" in many cases. As much as the international brigades were assisting in a practical manner, either on the battlefield or in the hospitals and other aid centers, they were also a huge boost to the morale of the Republicans, who felt that they weren't alone in this fight, despite the existence of the non-intervention committee and the apathy demonstrated by many democratic countries. These roughly 3,500 troops joined the Republican forces in fighting in the Casa de Campo and further south in the suburb of Carabanchel. Although everyone had originally been terrified of the Army of Africa and the Republican side would sustain heavy losses during the fighting, these Moroccan and Nationalist troops who had been fighting out in the vast, empty, and agrarian territory that mostly comprises Spain was far less apt at fighting in a city. The Republican defenders had the upper hand of knowing the city better and their position and their possession of the high ground in many cases. They had the recently supplied artillery, which was well positioned and therefore allowed them to take out large numbers of Nationalists as they approached their positions. Between the 9th and 10th of November, a third of the international brigades that had been sent out initially to fight were killed, but General Barella, who was in charge of the Nationalist defense, decided it was impossible to take the city across the Casa de Campo. The Nationalists increased the frequency of their bombing raids and started to use incendiary weapons to create more damage and fear in the masses. The Republicans held back the attack in Carabanchel, but were unable to drive the Nationalists back. The Russian aircraft were also unable to wipe out their Nationalist enemies in the skies over Madrid. Around November 13th, Durruti arrived with around 4,000 volunteer anarchists, having been convinced to leave Aragon and come defend Madrid by the minister Frederica Monseny. He and his forces were unfortunately not used in the best manner possible. They were ordered to charge the Nationalist forces on November 15th, backed up by the Republican artillery and air support. But many thought that this was a way for the communists to discredit the anarchists and lead them to the slaughter in one fell swoop to undermine this major power base and ideological competitor. When these troops were ordered to face the Nationalists and their machine gun fire, they abandoned their positions en masse. The Nationalists, backed up by the Condor Legion for the first time in a ground assault in the war, used this opportunity to drive across the river Manzanares that makes up the eastern edge of the Casa de Campo and into the University City. Thus, they were able to take the School of Architecture and some adjacent buildings on the campus. Many more Nationalists now flowed over the river and into this large section of the city proper. This led to a war within the city that was like a dark parallel version of the United Nations. People there would have been heard shouting in every European language, songs being sung supporting all sorts of political factions, and people from the same country readily killing one another over political differences of a country that they weren't even citizens of in many cases. People were killing each other by hand for the possession of rooms and floors and buildings. One International Brigade's members put bombs on an elevator to kill Moroccans in the floor above them. Some animals being kept in medical facilities for experimentation purposes were eaten by members of the Army of Africa, which led to their being infected with the diseases they contained and dying. Buildings were fought for until the last man died, as was the case of the Dąbrowski Battalion, mostly made up of Polish volunteers. And one of the greatest hits to the Republican and anarchist cause, Durruti was mortally wounded in front of the model prison on November 19th and died the next day. Now, none of his utopian visions of a Spain made up of independent libertarian communes would come true. He died in the Ritz Hotel, which for the time had been changed into an ad hoc hospital for the wounded. His funeral in Barcelona was attended by thousands, people who surely weren't only mourning the greatest war hero in Spanish anarchist history, but also the high point in their political movement, which they must have known had come, and with Durruti's death, clearly gone. He was only 40 years old at the time of his death. The nationalist attack on the university city lasted until November 23rd, and the forces under General Mola managed to capture and hold around three-quarters of the buildings on campus. Both sides built fortifications and dug trenches, but the nationalists found that they couldn't advance further into the city without heavy losses that they couldn't spare. They would, at the same time, put Madrid under a bombing campaign, the likes of which wouldn't be seen again until the Second World War broke out. Bombs fell from the sky and were launched by artillery set up just outside the city. The bombers still lacked the technical capability to communicate with one another by radio, and they had very little ability to aim their bombs precisely. This was mostly a campaign of terror, and between November 19th and 23rd, approximately 150 people were killed in these raids. Reporters on the ground said it was terrifying at all times because no matter how far away the bombs fell, they always sounded like they were headed straight for you. But as the British would learn during the bombing raids Germany carried out against them at the start of the Second World War, oftentimes such campaigns generate more hatred in the enemy and perseverance to continue fighting than terrifying a population into giving up or admonishing their leaders to do so. From this point forward, Madrid was in a state of siege. The anxiety this produced made a fear of a fifth column of nationalist, monarchist, or fascist supporters in the city even more acute, and those in charge in the city attempted to root out any that would oppose the government that remained. A few episodes back, I noted that the city was full of people that sympathized with or were members of right-wing political parties prior to the outbreak of the Civil War. They were effectively trapped there and had to seek refuge in the different embassies scattered around it. Fake embassies had even been created to house all of these people. For this reason, one of the big targets of these crackdowns on a potential fifth column occurred in these embassies. The police visited the Finnish embassy and upon knocking were fired on from within. They stormed the building and found 525 middle-class people hiding inside. Many embassy officials from other countries were guarding the inhabitants of their buildings and were the thin line protecting the political refugees from certain imprisonment and possible lynching. The fighting in and around Madrid would continue throughout the winter. At the same time this fighting was going on in the capital, another major event was occurring in another part of the country. That was the trial of José Antonio Primo de Rivera, the prisoner of the Republic who had founded the Falange political party, was the son of the prior dictator, and in whose name militias were fighting the government that had had him in custody. Even though Franco had co-opted his party and message, originally more anti-religious and open to more socialist-style economic policies, which Franco and the nationalists now directly opposed, José Antonio still represented the right wing in Spain, and many wished to take out their grievances with the nationalist military uprising on him. He was allowed to defend himself in open court by reading columns he had written in newspapers that clearly differentiated his views from those espoused by the nationalists. There was a failed attempt to bust him out of prison by force. Later, a Falangist militia leader snuck into the town of Alicante, where he was being held, and attempted to bribe him out, but couldn't find anyone willing to do it. José Antonio even proposed that he be flown to Salamanca to work out a peace between the two sides, and in exchange, he would leave his family behind as the government's hostages. This proposal was denied. At the conclusion of his trial, he successfully argued that his brother and his sister-in-law not be executed, but he would not escape that fate. President Azaña was even contacted by a close friend of José Antonio, who begged the president to intervene on his behalf, which he had successfully done on several occasions in the past. This time he replied that he had no power any longer and was himself a kind of prisoner of the government in his gilded cage separated from the actual government up in Barcelona. His death sentence was sent for review by the government on November 20th, but the local leaders in Alicante had him taken out and shot the same day, fearing that they would commute his sentence. The ministers seem to have all been in favor of reducing the sentence to life imprisonment, but they never got the chance to express that opinion, and they didn't take any action against those in Alicante who had carried out this most likely illegal execution. As it was, José Antonio's execution was a huge boon to Franco and the Nationalists, although at first they didn't actually acknowledge his death and he went unmentioned in the Nationalist press. One of Franco's potential greatest rivals for power, if he won the war, had been eliminated, and apparently the two men disliked each other personally. Franco was a man who had worked his way up from almost nothing, while José Antonio had been born the son of the dictator. Franco was a hard worker, rarely drank, and wasn't known to see women that weren't his wife. José Antonio, on the other hand, was a handsome playboy who drank like an Andalusian man was expected to. Franco must have been privately happy to hear about his rival's execution and immediately started thinking about how to exploit its having taken place. Back to the Madrid front, fighting had reached a stalemate in the university city, and on December 13th, the Nationalists decided to try an attack on the highway that connected Madrid and La Coruña in the northeast of the city near the small pueblo of Boadilla. Their hope was to slowly encircle the city and cut it off from relief from Republican-held parts of the country. There were around 18,000 infantry and cavalry under the supreme command of General Orgaz, but in the field led by General Barrela. The pueblo was taken in a night by Nationalist forces, but the Republicans, with the support of Russian tanks and two international brigades, launched themselves at them immediately thereafter. The Nationalists managed to hold the town and some territory that didn't make a whole lot of difference in the larger scheme of things, but would lose at least 100 soldiers in order to do so. The Nationalists ceased their offensive. In a desperate attempt to distract the Nationalist forces, the newly organized Republican Army of the South attacked the Nationalists on the Córdoba front to the south of Madrid. Although many died after the fighting to the last man on the Republican side, the battle itself was quickly won by Nationalists and resulted in them gaining a great deal more territory, which contained arable land and a hydroelectric station. The failure and retreat were so embarrassing to the Republicans that a battalion commander named Major Gaston de La Salle was accused of spying for the Nationalists, found guilty, and shot. He died screaming for his colleagues to believe his innocence, but he was the sacrificial lamb for the losses suffered on the battlefield. After Christmas, the Nationalists decided to attempt one last push in the area around Boadilla to cut off the road between Madrid and La Coruña. The Nationalists were reinforced by new Spanish conscripts as well as members of fascist militias who previously probably spent more of their time harassing supposed leftists on the Nationalist side than fighting the enemy directly. They were met by five divisions or about 50,000 troops in total on the Republican side. This part of the province of Madrid was and is mostly made up of wealthy suburban houses that made for good defensive structures by the Republicans, making it very costly for the Nationalists to take ground. The Nationalists were aided by aerial bombing, tanks, and mobile artillery before men were sent in afterwards. This style of warfare at first terrified the Republican forces, and they were unable to hold against the onslaught. The German officers present were fascinated and elated by this success, and certainly reported the results back to their government. A new column was sent out to hold out in the town of Las Rosas, but were unable to advance past that point. The Nationalists were steadily gaining ground by January 10th, but the Republican forces were holding out formidably against tanks, aerial bombing, and mobile artillery. On that day, the 14th and 12th International Brigades arrived in Madrid and were immediately sent to the fighting in the north. With their support, the Nationalists were forced into a stalemate by January 15th, by which time approximately 15,000 men had been killed on both sides. For all of this, the Nationalists had gained around 7 miles of highway and created a small bubble on the Republican lines. At this point in the war, neither side had the capability to keep up more than one major front at once. The Nationalists had hoped to overwhelm Madrid in a few days, at most weeks, and then that would demoralize the rest of Republican Spain enough to just give up. They hadn't counted on the Russian and other international support arriving just in time to foil these plans. They also overestimated their side's ability to take down a city of almost 1 million people. The Army of Africa that had so terrified the Republicans at the outset of the war had proven that a lot of their fame was gained taking on people who were technologically inferior to them in places where their enemies had to leave town to hide. Fighting the Republicans, newly supported by the most modern military technology the world was producing at the time, pushed the Nationalists back on their heels and sent Franco especially looking for ways to burnish their image and revive the hopes of their side in the war. Now the entire country was on edge, with both sides ignorant of where the enemy may try to strike next, push through, and take more territory. Madrid was saved for the moment, but it wasn't in good shape. Supplies rotted on the side of the roads headed into the city, as their drivers didn't want to risk their lives taking them into the city proper, which was being bombed regularly. A great deal of the livestock that had been in the city had been slaughtered and eaten at the beginning of the siege, in the general fear and anxiety that comes with near-death experiences. As it was dead winter, there wouldn't have been many opportunities to farm for food either. The Nationalists had also taken over the vast majority of the agricultural lands in the country, stifling the Republicans' ability to continue feeding their people. The Red Cross and multiple other international and local organizations were formed in order to try and feed the masses in the city, but supplies ran low. I'll finish up this week's episode by rewinding a little to October 12, 1936, to talk about what was taking place on the Nationalist side behind the lines philosophically. The Republicans were basically subordinating their stated philosophy's political goals in order to win the war, while the Nationalists were coming up with a new political philosophy on the fly. At this stage, they were very much leaning into the concept that all of the killing, torturing, mutilating, and imprisonment of their enemies was indeed a very good thing that was ordained and supported by God. This really irked a famous Basque essayist, novelist, poet, playwright, philosopher, and professor of Greek and classics named Miguel de Unamuno, who happened to find himself on the Nationalist side of the conflict when it broke out. He was, at the time, the rector of the ancient University of Salamanca. It was founded in 1134, in rebel-held Castilla-León. On this day in October, there was a celebration of the anniversary of Columbus's discovery of America. This was called the Day of the Race, or El Día de la Raza, and the ceremony was being held in the Great Hall of the University with Unamuno present. A number of higher-ups in the church and the military were also there, including the man who had invited Franco to lead the Foreign Legion in Morocco all those years ago, General Millán Astre. This guy cut quite a figure as he wore an eye patch, was missing one arm, had mutilated fingers on his remaining hand, and wore a full military uniform. One speaker got up and spoke out fervently against Catalonian and Basque separatism, comparing them to a cancer that Spanish fascism would surgically remove from the body politic. Someone in the crowd shouted the motto of the Foreign Legion, Viva la muerte, which means long live death. Millán Astre did a simple call and response where he called out, Spain, and was answered by the audience saying, One, he shouted, Spain. Again, and the audience replied with, Great! And then once more he said the name of the country and heard, Free! Called out in response. Once his curt oration was included, it was left to Unamuno to conclude the meeting. It was well known by many in the audience that he was not in agreement with many in the military, church, and government, by which he was entirely surrounded. He said the following, All of you are hanging on my words. You all know me and are aware that I am unable to remain silent. At times, to be silent is to lie, for silence can be interpreted as acquiescence. I want to comment on the speech, to give it that name, of Professor Maldonado, who had spoken ill of Basque and Catalonian nationalism. Let us waive the personal affront implied in the sudden outburst of vituperation against the Basques and the Catalans. I was myself born in Bilbao. The bishop, he pointed at the man sitting near him, whether he likes it or not, is a Catalan from Barcelona. Just now I heard a necrophilistic and senseless cry, long live death. And I, who have spent my life shaping paradoxes which have aroused the uncomprehending anger of others, I must tell you, as an expert authority, that his outlandish paradox is repellent to me. General Millán Astre is a cripple. Let it be said without any slighting undertone, he is a war invalid. So was Cervantes. Unfortunately, there are all too many cripples in Spain just now, and soon there will be even more of them, if God does not come to our aid. It pains me to think that General Estrée should dictate the pattern of mass psychology. A cripple who lacks the spiritual greatness of a Cervantes is wont to seek ominous relief in causing mutilation around him. At this, Mian Estrée couldn't hold his tongue and shouted out, "Death to intellectuals! Long live death!" To which he got applause from many in the audience. Another person trying to shout down the rector shouted, "Down with false intellectuals! Traitors!" But Unanimo continued to speak. "This is the temple of the intellect, and I am its high priest. It is you who profane its sacred precincts. You will win, because you have more than enough brute force, but you will not convince. For to convince, you need to persuade, and in order to persuade, you would need what you lack, reason and right in the struggle. I consider it futile to exhort you to think of Spain. I have done." Then one of Mian Astre's bodyguards pointed his machine gun at Unanimo, and the rector of the university would probably have died in a bloody hail of bullets right then if Franco's wife, Doña Carmen, hadn't been present. She went up to the rector and asked for his arm, knowing that it would protect him, and they left the room together in what I imagine was a stunned silence. Perhaps not understanding the extent to which he had insulted the society which surrounded him, he attempted to go and have drinks at his gentleman's club that evening, only to be shouted at by other members. They called him a red and a traitor, two of the most common slurs used to identify any leftist on the nationalist side. He was encouraged to leave the club by a close friend, and he did. He wasn't killed in the aftermath, but he did have an armed guard assigned to follow him, both to watch him and keep him safe. The Senate of the university called for his dismissal, and he died at home in his sleep on December 31, 1936. A concentration camp for Republican prisoners was later named after him in a dark joke by the people he had offended with his remarks. Regardless of the loss of his power and meeting his death saddened by the rejection of his peers, Unanimo was nonetheless 100% on point with his remarks. The nationalists, including Mola, Franco, Yagüe, and all of the other then late conspirators, had a goal of taking over Spain militarily, and they planned to work out the actual political organization of it afterwards. But they would never do it using political science, logic, or other rational factors, and instead did what made the small group of leaders at the top happy at the expense of the Spanish populace. The Germans and Italians didn't exactly support the extreme Catholicism that had mixed with Spanish fascism to create their current governmental structure. More so, they hated communist, socialist, and other left-wing political ideologies and were happy to see them stamped out with their help. Whatever happened after the war was over meant little to them as long as they repaid their debts. The people with power and money on the nationalist side had thrown their support behind Franco because he was a great military leader, not because he had a keen political mind, and he didn't. At this stage in the war, he was mostly keeping himself aloof and distant in order to build up a cult of personality, but it was definitely a Wizard of Oz situation. He was all too happy to delegate his political and military responsibilities to close family members and his veteran colleagues while he theorized strategy up in his castle in Burgos. Unfortunately, Franco did reflect the declaration of death to intellectuals and would build his political policies more on what he thought about his enemies, that they had been brainwashed by foreigners to hate Spain, than the fact that there were many good reasons for the agricultural workers, miners, and middle-class people to want to experiment with new political policies. So his government would indeed become a paradox. He'd be treated like a king, but not be one. He'd preach Christian values while very much doing the opposite and enacting the slogan, "Long live death." And he'd have no trouble reconciling this in his own mind without ever being able to convince anyone outside of Spain of the internal logic behind it. What Unanimo did was brave, but it wouldn't make much difference in the short term as the Spanish Civil War carried on into 1937.